So, the topic is happiness, which maybe is a happiness-producing topic or an irritant. But it's a wonderful thing, and people who study happiness point out that there are other terms that come from the Greek who started this kind of philosophical investigation to happiness. And one of them is the idea of flourishing, that we can flourish in our life. So you get a different feeling than if you just talk about happiness. And in fact, if you look back around the same time as these ancient Greeks, like Aristotle, was the Buddha. And the Buddha also was emphasizing happiness, study of happiness. And it's not a coincidence, I think, because both the ancient Greeks, like Aristotle and people, and the Buddha were trying to come up with a way of flourishing. The Buddhist language, there's a word that means thriving, to thrive, without recourse to theology, to gods and instructions and teachings from some god or some gods, but rather something that humans could enter into themselves, find for themselves, and become their own teachers, their own guide, find their own path. So it wasn't a matter of going and finding some ultimate teaching somewhere, as it is to find guidance to point to how we can find a way forward to happiness, to thriving, to peace, to freedom, all terms that are sometimes used as to describe the ultimate goal of Buddhist practice. And it's a big field. Nowadays, there's a field of positive psychology that's looking at happiness. It's a relatively new. And the Buddha wasn't alone in among the ancients, who was also doing an in-depth study of happiness. And he described a lot of different forms of happiness and causes of happiness and qualities of happiness and joy and delight and contentment, inspiration, all kinds of things that by which we thrive. The emphasis in Buddhism on letting go, and if you talk about letting go and then, no self, some people don't see how this is a recipe for happiness and for thriving. Some people find it kind of depressing or discouraging, these teachings. But those teachings of letting go, focusing on suffering, understanding it, teachings on not self, are meant to be a stepping stone or a means or a door, opening of a door to, in fact, a human flourishing, a human thriving, a human. You're not diminished through Dharma practice. In anything, you are opened up. There can be emerged this wonderfulness in us, a strength, a beauty, a freedom. And in fact, in the ancient teachings of the Buddha, someone who is fully awakened is not a Mr. Nobody who just kind of recedes into the wallpaper and doesn't really count, but rather someone who has no limitations, no restrictions, no bondage, no nothing clamps them down. Their inner life has been set free to flow and be. And people, as they become free, become more themselves in a confident, clear, kind of, empowered way. We don't say that very often because it's too easy for people's conceit to get on the bandwagon then. Oh, I can't wait to be empowered and confident and strong, and I'll just have this. They'll probably give me a badge. I can walk around my block and everyone will know how great I am. So no badge. So there, we've been talking about these different kinds of happiness. And the first is that the happiness of practice, the happiness of having a path of practice, which is partly a happiness of having a purpose. One of the fundamental human needs is to have a sense of purpose, a meaning for our lives. And this is a powerful purpose. It's considered to be a noble purpose. And so, you know, it has a dignity, it has value. In the Buddhist perspective, the goal, the path to liberation from suffering, the path to freedom, is one of the greatest goals a human being can pursue. Not only is it a path to become free of suffering, it's also a path to become someone who loves non-harming. And this world of ours is filled with people harming each other, filled with people who harm themselves. And there might be other wonderful goals. There are wonderful goals and purposes to life. But from a Buddhist point of view, the fundamental one, the one that is, you know, to deal with first, is this end of suffering. All the other ones can follow. But this possibility, and that's what we want for other people. I mean, one of the great movements is compassion in Buddhism, is to want everyone to be free of suffering. What a great thing to live in a world where that could be possible. But to have that as a purpose, to move in that direction and become someone who matures along this path to liberation, to value it, not only for oneself, but for others. Your practice supports other people's practice. However much you develop and grow in this practice, you'll inspire others to maybe do the same, or maybe you help other people to relax and open up. Repeatedly in my life, I have met people, especially when I was newer in practice, I met people who inspired me tremendously, not because they didn't suffer, but they had this delightful, wonderful way to not suffer because they suffered. I knew people who had fear, and they would just have this glitter and gleam in their eye and smile. Yeah, I'm afraid. They weren't embarrassed. They weren't shooting second arrows at themselves. They had clean. They kind of worked themselves enough that, yes, they had practice to do. They had something to work through. But they were just kind of, they had nothing to prove or disprove towards anybody else. They just, okay, this is who I am. This openness and clarity. And they had this purpose. It inspired me on my path. Wow, it's possible to do this. So to have a sense of purpose, to be inspired, and then to engage in this path, not only to have a purpose, but to be able to follow through on it. And it's very easy for some of us, I think, to take the experience of coming on retreat for granted. It's so easy. Just kind of, you know, some of you came from Santa Cruz. You just kind of like, you know, pop over and in the ancient world, just less than a century ago, less than 100 years ago, there are stories of people who wanted to learn to meditate, and they would walk for months to find a teacher deep in the jungle or in the mountains, in Burma and in Thailand, places like that. It wasn't so easy just to turn on YouTube to get some little bit of teaching. You had to go find someone, and let alone once you found them, then to have the wherewithal to do the practice was not easy. They didn't have retreat centers 100 years ago. They might have had some monasteries here and there, but anything like this is kind of a modern, relatively new luxury and phenomena that we can come and do this. We're engaged in a practice that we're so lucky. We are, in the history of humanity, we're so phenomenally fortunate to be able to have this practice, to be able to do it. Even if you're the worst practitioner here, for which none of you are, but even if you were, what a great thing you're doing. You're doing one of the great things in this human life. That this is the Buddhist orientation. So, and then to be able to, so it's one thing to have the purpose, the other is to follow through on it, to be able to do this practice. One of the things I've seen in my many years now of being a teacher is to watch some people change in some ways kind of quickly. But what inspires me the most is the people who just keep practicing day after day, week after week, month after month, and to watch the incremental changes over time and see a shift and change in their bodies, their face, their eyes, their demeanor, their how they talk and all kinds of things. Wow. You can't see it every day, but slowly. So the happiness of having a practice, the happiness of being able to practice. They're kind of the representative story in my life for this was I was introduced to Vipassana practice. And it made a big impression on me. And it was a 10-week retreat. So that was long enough to make an impression. That was my introduction. And it became essential that I go back and do more of it. I'd gone back to the United States. I wanted to go back. But now I wanted to go to Burma because that was where this practice that I was doing it came from. But it was difficult to get the visa to go to Burma. So I applied a few times, and it took about 9 months to get the visa to go. The country had been closed entirely for Westerners until just a few months before I got my visa. So it was relatively new to be able to go into Burma. And I got my visa stamped in my passport in Bangkok. And I was so happy. I skipped down the street and outside the street down the from the embassy and sang to myself, I'll just say it because I can't sing. You can get it if you really want, but you gotta try, God. the happiness of being, finally, I can go and practice. This is what I wanted to do. This is like the most important, that was the most important thing for me to do in my life at that time. I got that visa. I could go and do it. And then there's the happiness of no longer being caught up in the hindrances. Wow. One of the great human needs is autonomy. To have ability to decide and choose for oneself. I'm on an ethics committee at a local hospital, and one of the highest ethical principles that the medical staff adhere to is every patient's autonomy. And they have to guarantee, they spend time looking at it, what does it mean, and how do we guarantee and make sure that people can make their own choice. Autonomy is something that's very important for people. We are not autonomous beings when we're caught by the hindrances. When we're being driven and pushed around by our desires, caught in the grip of our anger and hostilities, when we're swamped with, resistance and sloth and torpor. These are ways in which we are not free. And to finally have the hindrances quiet down enough, not disappear forever, but quiet down enough, and feel this feeling of being kind of a clarity or a cleanse, cleanseness in the mind, or feeling like my mind hasn't been taken over by the pirates anymore. But now, wow, I'm present. I can direct my mind. I can open my mind. I'm not caught by anything. Wow, that took a long time to get to that point. Sometimes it takes days and weeks, sometimes years to find that. It's one of the really worthwhile things to do is to take the time, however long it's going to be, to no longer be enslaved, imprisoned by the hindrances. And so the happiness of a kind of autonomy, happiness of being set free from these things that had such a strong push and control over our lives is one of the great things happiness is to experience. To not be in bondage to our, and it's really very much related to this idea of bondage to our beliefs, our thoughts, our emotions, our desires. To, you know, our beliefs push us around, keep us trapped. Our thoughts do. Our emotions do. I was reminded recently of a woman at part of IMC who died of ALS. And she was a great practitioner. And for a good while she was sick, at some point she was in a hospital bed in the living room. And people from IMC loved to go see her and just hang out with her because she was so at peace. There was so much equanimity. And she was just like darshan to be in the room with her and just be with her and so it was kind of, it was inspiring. But then I went to see her that last day she was alive. And with, I don't know if you, with ALS, if you, it takes its, one of its courses is that you can't breathe anymore. And because you can't breathe, you can't somehow move the fluids out of your lungs and you suffocate. And so she was not in any pain, but at some point she couldn't get enough oxygen. And so you start hallucinating things. And so she said, Gil, and she was kind of distressed and she was agitated. And she said to me, Gil, I can't practice anymore. Like, you know, she'd been practicing so well and that she was a refuge and support. I can't practice anymore. And I said to her, and she talked about these images and hallucinations she was seeing. And I said to her, it's okay. You don't have to practice anymore. All you have to do is don't believe the hallucinations. She immediately relaxed. And the agitation and everything calmed down. And then 2 hours later, she died. You don't have to believe your thoughts. You don't have to believe everything. How many, I mean, certainly some beliefs are good beliefs to have. I don't want to knock all beliefs. What I want to knock is being trapped by our beliefs, being caught by them, being enslaved to them, to see the world only through the filter of our beliefs. We don't have to. And so this kind of freedom from the hindrances, it relates also to this freedom from having to believe our beliefs, having to be caught by them, allowing ourselves to settle. The happiness of freedom from hindrances. So when the hindrances abate, and this autonomy is also related to the ability to now be fully present to the experience here and now. Because we're not so easily pulled away into thoughts and ideas. The hindrances have a big part of that fuel that keeps us spinning out in our thoughts and reactivity and all that. To really be here. And I find it very interesting that there's a this I mentioned earlier, this positive movement for positive psychology. There is a subfield in it called hedonic psychology. And it's the study of happiness. And one of the leading researchers for this field is a man named Daniel Kahneman. And surprisingly, his definition of happiness is, you know, this guy who studied all the different research and had done one in the forefront of it all. So, you know, he has some, you know, some interest to know how he defines happiness. He defines happiness, and most people can't understand it, I think, but maybe you will. Why this is a definition of happiness. He defines it as the experience of here and now. Isn't that, first time I saw that, I said, what? That's all? The experience of here and now. But once the hindrances have abated, once the mind has become quiet and the beliefs don't take over and we're settled and here in the present moment. Maybe it's not the same thing as happiness, but boy, is that good. Just be here with our experience as it is, not fighting it or running away from it or constructing all kinds of stories and ideas, just this here. Then there's the happiness of concentration. When I first was introduced to this practice in Thailand in this 10-week retreat, the beginning when I first got to the monastery, I was introduced to a monk who they said had the ability to go into very deep states of concentration where the cessation of perception and feelings and he could sit there for 7 days at a time without moving. So, you know, it's like, wow, is this possible? So I never saw him do that, but I was introduced to him. But when I looked into his eyes, I kind of said, oh, I guess he can. His eyes were so deep, like they just like went in deep, and like he was so the stillness, the quiet, the clarity was, you know, it was just quite something. So I asked him, "What have you attained from all your years of practice, all your meditation? What have you attained?" And he said, and this surprised me. He said, non-contention. Non-contention. What? That's it? Maybe another way of saying it, non-conflict. He wasn't in conflict with anything anymore. Come to IRC for a 7-day retreat and bring conflict to an end. We call it a non-conflict retreat instead of a meditation retreat. Would you come? So anyway, I was inspired by that answer. Partly I was inspired because it wasn't what I expected. And that gave me a pause to think and reflect on this. So concentration is often associated with huffing and puffing, with a laser focus, with sometimes bearing down, kind of narrowing attention. Another way of thinking of concentration is that it is the ending of resistance, the ending of contention, the ending of conflict with our experience. It's to be in harmony with our experience. This unification, where everything is included, everything that our whole system here, you know, our internal system, starts coming into harmony. It's all working together. We're not in conflict with ourselves. We're not opposed to ourselves. We're not contending with inner conflicts and ideas. We're here. And this introduces another fundamental human need. So I've talked about the need for purpose, the need for autonomy. Another fundamental need is a need for belonging. And when we're able to have unified and collected, no longer in conflict, there's a feeling, there's whether it's conscious or not, there's that now we belong. At least we belong to ourselves. And we belong, we're here, we're allowed to be here, we're justified to be here. There's no question about yes. We don't have to, there's not a belittling of ourselves or denying of ourselves or separating from ourselves or feeling that, you know, that I don't belong. There's a sense of feeling yes. And I think for me, I associate that with the gesture the Buddha's making in the statue we have on the altar, with his right hand drapes over his right knee to touch the earth. And that earth-touching gesture is to belong, in this case, to this earth, to be here. And so to think of concentration not as this, you know, intense focus, but rather as this wholehearted settling, wholehearted things coming together. The image that I love for concentration is that of a very large bowl, where we had these when I was at when I took my kids to these discovery museums for kids, science museums for kids. They had these big bowls, and you'd put like a quarter or a marble at the top of the bowl, and they would go around and up and down the sides. And you can lean over and push the marbles, and they would have momentum, and they'd never stop if they kept pushing them. But if you left them alone, they would gradually slow down. And in the case of the museums, there was just a little hole in the bottom of the bowl, and the marble would fall through. But if it had too much momentum, it would just sail over the hole. But I like this image for concentration of a big bowl, maybe without a hole in the bottom, and all the things, all the momentums and conflicts and the different directions we're going, all our marbles, our loose marbles, they come and slow down and come together, meet together at the center. They're all in a certain kind of way at rest. There. So samadhi has rest. When I was also one of my first times I was practicing in Thailand, I met a monk, a Western monk, who was kind of dismissive about concentration practice. And he said, concentration is just about letting go. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Just about letting go. That gave me a whole different twist about what concentration is. As, you know, letting go. So it's almost like letting go of everything that distracts us. So we settle into the bottom of the bowl in a focused, clear way. So we belong to ourselves, free of conflict. And there's a sense in concentration, you know, being settled in this way in samadhi, of being protected. And humans have the need to feel safe. Not an easy thing to do in this world of ours. But there is a very significant kind of safety that, you know, if we're able to have the ability to sit and get focused and centered and relaxed, and that there's a deep sense of safety in that place of samadhi. It can be very healing to experience that, especially if there's been a lot of lack of safety in life elsewhere. Now we finally come to the topic for today. No, we have to still do equanimity. Happiness of equanimity. I associate this with this equanimity with being available for life. It is a kind of non-reactivity, non-agitation, but it means that we're not defending ourselves. We're not ready to react against something or for anything, but we have a confidence to be still, quiet, open, present, to experience this life. Some people think of equanimity maybe as being something dull, but it's actually a rich experience of being available for all of this life, to feel it and be with it. And the happiness of no longer dwelling in our hurts, our fears, our angers. These are all things that work as triggers for whatever takes us away from equanimity. But to have a healing of our hurts, healing of our angers and our fears, the movement towards healing and reconciliation is another very important human need. And there's something about developing and coming into some kind of equanimity that is a healing, is a settling, is a reconciliation of the, you know, so the things that divide us, the things that keep us separate, keep us, you know. And so, and one of the, is another kind of equanimity, is another form of safety. And the kind of safety I associate with equanimity is we become safe for ourselves. Because the mind is no longer reactive, we're able to be present in this clear, non-reactive way. We have the happiness of knowing I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm not going to shoot second arrows. It's bad enough to have suffering, but I'm not going to suffer because I suffer. So I can hold everything. They're available. There's space to hold this experience like this here, to hold this life. So then we come to the happiness of liberation. And that's the topic for today. I wanted to go over a review these different areas because it's a little bit progressive. They kind of, these earlier forms of happiness are supporting the happiness of liberation, the possibility of freedom. And it's kind of important to understand that because there are people who want to do the direct route to concentration, direct route to equanimity, the direct route to liberation. And I don't think there is a direct route except through cultivating some degree of inner flourishing, inner thriving, inner well-being, inner happiness. Without that, there's a tension, there's a fragility, there's an agitation, there's a reactivity that's going to get in the way of really settling deeply. If that big bowl has all the marbles finally resting in the bottom, when we get concentrated, it turns out that the bowl has layers. There's another bowl underneath it that's even bigger. And so at some point, the marbles can drop in there and rest there. So this deeper, quieter, more peaceful happiness that prepares the ground for a deep letting go. And letting go release. Sometimes they use the word abandoning in the texts. Relinquishment is considered the action, the activity of the deepest endpoints, final steps in the path of practice. And it's the ending of suffering. That's the great purpose of this practice that we talked about at the beginning. The ending of the inclination to harm anybody. People who are enlightened love non-harming. What a great thing. And in the tradition, liberation is considered to be the ultimate safety. All the other happinesses provide a certain kind of safety, but they are not the happiness that has no opposite. If you have the happiness of a purpose and of the practice, then if for some reason you can't practice, you lose that happiness. If you have the happiness of being free of the hindrances, but the hindrances return, you have maybe the opposite of certain discouragement or worse. Have the happiness of concentration, but that can disappear easily. And then you might be discouraged and feel depressed. I had it so good. What happened? The happiness of equanimity can be lost in a flash. I've, you know, been very equanimous, very peaceful on retreat, and I got it made. And then go down to the meal, and the person in front of me in line took the last cookie. And that's all it took for me to lose my equanimity. And and then I have the cookie suffering. But the happiness of liberation is a letting go that is not a temporary letting go, but something clearly comes to a stop that does not return. And it's not going to return. And because of that, there's no swinging of the pendulum. It's a happiness that has no opposite. It just is there by itself. The happiness of freedom. I kind of believe that it's the heart's wish to be free. And maybe many people might have very different language to describe the same thing. Some people might call it the heart's yearning, or there might be all kinds of other kind of words they use. But how I see it is that any time there is clinging to anything, if I make a fist, if I hold that fist for a long time, there's going to be a strong, almost like a physical desire for me to relax the effort from holding that fist so tight. In a sense, there is the wish in the fist to relax. Come on, Gil, cut it out. Please, leave me alone. Let the hand relax. And I have to kind of reassert my mind's effort to keep it holding on to the fist, because there's a strong momentum to just let go, to relax it. The freedom that we're getting through Buddhism is a freedom from clinging, from grasping, from attachment, which always takes work. It's effort to cling. even though we don't see it, it's so second nature for us, or it's so invisible, the effort we're doing, but it's effort. And as we get quieter and more sensitive, we'll feel, sense the pull, the call, the yearning, the heart's wish is to put it all down. And in Buddhism, sometimes that's what it's called, putting down the burden. We're carrying this burden and we put it down. Hey, we have permission to put it down. It's allowed to put it down. Not only is it appropriate and you have permission to put it down, to let go, it's a really generous thing to do. Letting go is not betraying. Letting go is giving the world and yourself the greatest gift. And in fact, many of the words that in the ancient Buddhist texts, words for letting go have double meanings. And they also mean generosity or giving. Kind of like the English expression giving up. I give up. And you might, you know, some people when they say I give up and they just collapse, I give up, you know. It's kind of like a depressing thing, I give up. But the original meaning of the word was to offer up for an altar, something that we're giving. The original meaning for sacrifice was to make sacred. That's what the Latin word sacrifice means, to make sacred. And now it's a burden. I have to sacrifice myself or something. But I think all these words, whether it's a Latin or the ancient Indic languages, the fact that this letting go and generosity and giving are so closely connected. And you kind of see it because when you offer something to someone, you have to let go of it. You have to give it up. Here, have it. And to think of this movement towards liberation, to really let go deeply as a kind of generosity. It's not just a loss of something, but it's also a gain. It's a gain of peace. You're giving yourself a profound peace. And as a peaceful person, you're putting that into the world. You're giving yourself a profound form of happiness, a happiness that has no opposite. And that's the gift for everyone. And so we learn to let go. We learn to let go in small ways. We learn to let go. Well, I guess I'm not having a cookie today. That person took the last one. That's okay. Can't let go of that. We learn to let go of all kinds of things. All the small letting goes that we do when done with wisdom are kind of opening us up, opening up. All these little movements are opening and that are going to grow and develop and mature. And to begin recognizing the happiness, the joy, the goodness, the satisfaction of letting go is what begins to support the maturation of letting go, the growth, the expansion of letting go. But we need to feel the goodness of it. I learned in my life, kind of the hard way, that if I let go of something, but it didn't have anything that was in the family of joy, even just a simple lightness. If I just felt neutral after I let go, I hadn't really let go. And if I let go, sometimes I would pat myself on the back. Okay, that was difficult, but you let go, and that was good. I could do that. But I was really neutral. I discovered that if I was neutral, it would come back and bite me. I hadn't really let go. To really let go, there had to be this lightening up. There had to be a kind of satisfying. It felt nourishing. It felt good. Oh, that's good. The happiness, the joy of letting go. And to begin to recognize that, the after effect of letting go. Oh, a small thing to do, but that was good. That was good. As we start recognizing that goodness of letting go, the after effect of it, it can begin, that begins to grow. And you start learning how to let go in better, bigger ways. And it grows. And you practice, and easier to let go when you meditate. Mm-hmm. Have your conceit that you have to be the best meditator. Gil says that you're the worst meditator at IRC, and you smile and say, wow, great. That makes things easier. I'm just let go of conceit. I don't, so what? Just let go. Let go. And then at some point, the more the letting go happens, the more the liberation, the freedom is, the greater the happiness. And because we're paying attention to the after effect of letting go, we'll get the feedback of whether the letting go is appropriate or not, whether we're letting go of the right thing. It's remarkable that in the teachings of the Buddha, as far as I can tell, and there's all this discussion about letting go, relinquishing, abandoning, it's never a thing. It's never a person. It's always the attachment, the clinging to the things, the attachment to things, the holding on, the grabbing. And so I'm fond of this movement. There's two ways of letting go. So this is going to be noisy. There's this way. Just kind of like, then it breaks or something. And there's also this way of letting go. Letting go of the grip, the holding. And I'm holding my hand open and flat, and the striker just rests in my hand. It's the letting go of the grasping that the Buddha emphasized. And as we do that and get the feedback, then we begin understanding much better what we were holding on to and how to be with it wisely and what is needed to be done, and how we are wise and maybe even forceful in our response to what happens in the world. But we learn to do it with an inner peace, an inner happiness that we've become familiar with from slowly, patiently, learning to recognize the happiness, the goodness, the rightness of releasing the holding, releasing the tension in the heart, the holding in the heart, right down to the bottom of the heart, just complete falling away. It's not an easy thing to do. But it slowly builds. We give ourselves to the practice. And as we give ourselves to the practice as if that, you know, the endless road we have to walk, we discover the happiness of just walking. We get into harmony, into shape, and we just get able to get in the flow of it. So good. We discover the happiness of not being caught so much anymore. Not caught in the hindrances, not caught in our beliefs, not caught in our, you know, in our conceits. And we still might have attachments, we still might have shortcomings. And the fantastic gesture, maybe, is if you have a shortcoming, maybe you have a little few small ones, and you recognize it, is you say, you step forward and open your hands wide and say, I have a shortcoming. Wow. People say, wow, that person has a shortcoming, but doesn't seem troubled by it. You're not embarrassed by it, not defended by it, not ashamed by it. We have a practice that holds it all, a practice that helps us be safe with it. And we don't add these second arrows that are often connected to the hindrances. And then coming to rest in this harmony, not non-contention, non-conflict. This too is included. This too is included. Everything gets included. No conflict. Everything gets to rest in the bowl. And then equanimity. A healing, a reconciliation where we're not triggered anymore. But we stay balanced, we stay open, we're available. And then to begin to have the bottom drop out of the bowl and all the marbles. Don't just go to the next bowl, next layer. At some point, they drop and they just evaporate. Let it all evaporate. Let it all go. And as Ajahn Chah is supposed to have said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a middling, you'll have a middling happiness. And if you let go fully, you'll have a full happiness. May the happinesses of the Dharma, Dharma happiness, be yours, and may it support you to have confidence in this practice and in this settling, deep settling, to be right here in this moment here. As we continue into this evening and tomorrow, perhaps there's a way that you can trust that it's your heart's wish to settle and to be here. May you feel that wish and follow it. Thank you.